Before we begin this week's Australian True Crime podcast, please excuse this blatant ad for my other podcast, The Nitty Gritty Committee. If you like hearing the stories of interesting people, and I know you do, then please seek it out wherever you get your podcasts. The current episode is a chat with a lady called Jodie, who is a Ghostbuster from Perth. So that's the sort of thing I'm into. Okay? All right, on with the crimes. This podcast is about the perpetrators of child sexual assault and may be triggering for some listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Just assume that there is a child sex offender on your street, because there probably is. And we should all be acting from that premise.
Dr. Kelly Richards is a senior lecturer in the law faculty of the Queensland University of Technology. She's also an expert in a field most of us try to avoid thinking about as much as possible, that of child sex offenders and what to do with them after their jail time is done. Kelly is an advocate of the innovative system being quietly trialled in South Australia at the moment that goes by the acronym COSA. It stands for Circle of Support and Accountability. And it involves volunteers from the community assisting child sex offenders as they try to transition back into the community after jail time. I started off by asking Dr. Kelly what was the most obvious question for me. How does one find themselves working so closely with child sex offenders?
So the sort of research that I do really grew out of an interest that I had in restorative justice. So sort of ways of doing justice that move beyond this very traditional focus that we have on retribution and punishment. And looking more at, I guess, the human side of crime and justice and ways that we can do things that actually meet the needs of victims and offenders. And so as part of that interest, I came to hear about this process called Circles of Support and Accountability, which was sort of this quite radical program for reintegrating sex offenders, and particularly child sex offenders. And so Circles of Support and Accountability, or COSA, is something that I've now been researching for 6 or 7 years. And I have had the fantastic opportunity to be able to go overseas, so to the UK and Canada and North America, and see some of these COSA programs in action.
Okay, now it makes sense, because I was wondering, you know, what's a nice girl like you doing hanging out with so many sexual offenders? But I guess if your passion and your interest is in what you call restorative justice, is it? In sort of rehabilitation?
Exactly, yeah.
Then these are the ultimate people to be trying to work with.
Absolutely. So restorative justice is related to rehabilitation, but it is different. Look, the best way to describe restorative justice is it really, instead of asking who needs to be punished here, it will ask what can be done to repair the harm. And I guess if we just extend that a tiny bit, then the question is, what can we do to repair harm and prevent future harm? And that's really where COSA fit in. So COSA, they're at what we would call the tertiary end of the criminal justice system. So they're working with men, and it is predominantly men, who have been convicted of child sex offences. So it's only a portion of all of the sex offenders in the community. But it's basically saying, look, we know these guys are problematic. Many of them reoffend or have the potential to reoffend. What can we do in that space to minimise that likelihood that they will reoffend? So in other words, what can we do here that's a really sensible approach to enhancing the safety of kids in our communities?
A lot of people would say that the only thing you can do, well, probably have two options, I suppose. One is lock them up for the rest of their lives, and the other is to do away with them. I'm sure you run into those arguments often.
Yes, absolutely. Look, there is a lot of misinformation out there, and there's a lot of confusion among community members. And look, that's completely understandable. We can't possibly expect everyone in the community to be an expert on this topic. And we have to acknowledge this is an incredibly emotive issue. People are angry and fearful, and that's understandable. The problem with let's just lock them up forever, or let's just send them to Manus Island or send them out to a desert somewhere. There's a few problems. First of all, it assumes that all sex offenders are the same and that they all pose the same risk and that they will all reoffend. And that simply isn't true. Many sex offenders won't reoffend. So many child sex offenders are quite opportunistic, actually. They will abuse children who they have an opportunity to offend. So that's usually their own children, or it's a niece or a nephew. It's someone in the family, right?
Mm-hmm.
As soon as that opportunity disappears, they won't, they're not predatory. They're not going to go out and start taking children off the street, okay? Then there is a very small cohort of offenders who are driven, who are compulsive, who probably have pedophilia, so they meet the diagnostic criteria for pedophilia. In other words, they have an enduring primary sexual interest in prepubescent children. And they will, these are the sort of the ones who will plan, who will kidnap children, who will put themselves deliberately in situations where they have access to children. They are only a small minority of all offenders, but they do pose a very serious risk. So some of this stuff around wanting to lock them up forever and you know, wanting to have very punitive, very restrictive policies in place actually makes sense if we're talking about that small cohort. It doesn't make sense if we're talking about all of the others. It's actually a waste of resources and, you know, scarce resources that we could be putting to, you know, to much more sensible use to really target those who are high-risk offenders in our community.
I'm interested in this group of people that, are you saying that there are people who've sexually assaulted children who you wouldn't call pedophiles?
Yes, absolutely. So there is an important distinction here between pedophiles and child sex offenders, and that obviously gets completely lost, not only in public discussion, but I would say also in academic discussion, but it's a vital distinction to make. So pedophiles are people who have an enduring sexual interest in prepubescent children. Okay, so they tell us that for them it is like being heterosexual or bisexual or homosexual. Their primary sexual interest is in young children. They feel it is something that they were born with. They feel it is something that they cannot change. Okay?
Yeah.
But just because somebody has pedophilia doesn't mean they abuse children. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's whole communities of people who call themselves virtuous pedophiles. And this is a group of people who acknowledge that that's their sexual orientation, if you like, but they also acknowledge that it would be harmful to act on it. And so they sort of form support communities and support one another to not act on their primary sexual interests. Then we have child sex offenders. Now, child sex offenders may be pedophiles, so they may have that enduring primary sexual interest in children, but many or most of them actually we think don't, okay? So most child sex offenders are not pedophiles. Most child sex offenders offend opportunistically, okay? So this is, you know, they're probably married, they're probably a heterosexual, they're probably in a long-term partnership with a woman, but if the right sort of circumstances arise or their inhibitions are lowered, you know, through drugs or alcohol or extreme stress or some combination of those things, or the behaviour is incredibly normalised in an institutional setting or in a community setting and they think they'll probably get away with it, then they will act in those circumstances. And, of course, some pedophiles are also child sex offenders. And you know, they belong to that high-risk group that I mentioned previously. So they are often the ones who are quite predatory and quite calculated and the ones who we really need to, you know, put our resources into preventing.
So, for example, with the Little Children Are Sacred report that was released some years ago now, probably a decade ago now, about child sexual abuse in Aboriginal communities, that... Because I never understood how that's happening, why that's happening, why more so in those communities. I guess that's that normalisation you were talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm glad that you raised that because you know, if we assume that all child sex offenders are pedophiles, then we have to also assume that there are more pedophiles in these in some Indigenous communities.
Yeah,
where this is
which doesn't
a
make
problem.
Sense.
And that doesn't make any sense.
No.
It doesn't make any sense at all. And so then we have to ask ourselves, well, if it's not pedophilia, like if it's not some innate biological sort of urge, then what does give rise to, you know, high rates of sexual abuse? And so, you know, then we start to see, well, you know, it is the normalisation of sexually harmful behaviours. It's, you know, very high rates of disinhibitors, so drugs and alcohol. It's, you know, overcrowding. It can be weak parental sort of control, so poorer supervision of children. You know, children can just be easier targets in those communities. If things aren't great at home, they tend to spend more time with their peers and on the streets, and so they are at increased risk then of you know, being targeted by an uncle or you know, someone else in the community. So that's really what we're seeing going on there. I don't think it's the case that there are, you know, an overrepresentation of pedophiles in those communities.
No, that makes sense. So it's symptomatic of the challenges that face dispossessed Aboriginal communities, I guess.
Right, absolutely. Which in some ways, you know, is a happier news story because we can do something about all of those things, about drugs and alcohol and mental health and the normalisation of sexually harmful behaviours and overcrowded housing. And, you know, we can address all of those things. Undoubtedly, that will take a very long time, but, you know, it gives us something to do that's really positive in this space that will make a difference to children's lives.
So I guess it feels equally troubling, though, that a person could take advantage of a situation who's not a paedophile in a way, who just, for whatever reason, acts out in this bizarre and horrible way once just because they can. How do you work with someone like that to make sure it doesn't happen again?
Yeah, it is. It's incredibly confronting, actually, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you know, I've done some work around public opinion around paedophilia and child sex offending. And look, I think not only do the public misunderstand that distinction, but I think there's a real resistance to acknowledging that somebody could offend against a child who isn't a paedophile.
Yeah.
Because that tells this whole other horrible story. But the fact is, we simply have to come to terms with the fact that people sometimes act in ways that we cannot comprehend.
And you believe it's possible for people to do that once, literally once, and never, I guess, through therapy and other things, never do that again?
Yes, it is. You know, a lot of child sex offenders aren't dedicated offenders in that they'll offend across a whole range of other offences as well. So they'll abuse a child one day, and the next day they'll steal a car, and the next day they will beat their wife, and the following week they might commit a fraud.
Wow.
Okay, so there's people who just don't really who are very impulsive and who don't really have any sort of regard for the law, and just sort of whatever they want, they, you know, they act in the moment and sort of hang the consequences, if you like.
Mm.
So those guys, you know, there's a way of intervening with them around, you know, reining in that impulsive behaviour and doing sort of victim empathy work, and also, you know, putting in place general preventative actions that aren't, you know, specific to child sex offending. And this is sometimes where we go off the rails a bit. We assume that all this group are the same and they're all pedophiles and they're all predatory, the sorts of things we put in place often miss the mark. I mean, actually, if we've got a big group of these guys are not dedicated to child sex offending, they just have no regard for anyone else in general terms.
Yeah.
And so addressing their general criminogenic needs, you know, is the way to treat those guys. With the guys who only ever act, you know, opportunistically, so they'll only act if there happens to be an available child in their own home. I mean, well, the solution there is actually quite simple. It's to remove opportunities, basically. So if we have a guy coming out of prison, well, obviously we won't send him back into a home environment where there are children who he could offend against. But he's probably not one of those who's going to get in the car and trawl around and try and pick up the young child. That's not part of his modus operandi. He's not a pedophile. He's an opportunistic offender. You know, and this group really forms a very large chunk of sex offenders in general. So the message then around prevention and around treatment is actually quite different from what, you know, the public imagines.
It still feels risky, though, doesn't it? It feels risky that, you know, then does the child across the road or next door represent an opportunity if they happen to wander into the yard or, you know, if they happen to be friendly and chatting over the fence? And it also feels a bit victim-blamey, like, well, if you bring let your child near me, it's your fault if I have sex with them.
I'd hate to think of it in those terms.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, I think it's more the case that, yeah, look, it's a combination of there's an opportunity here and I think I'm going to get away with it.
So what do? We tattoo their foreheads to say I'm one of those guys so that I shouldn't be given opportunities, you know?
Yeah, I mean, look, no would be my short answer.
Yeah.
I mean, what we can do is some, you know, really pragmatic, sensible stuff. You know, I mean, Victoria Corrections do a great job in terms of they've got someone coming out of prison for a child sex offence, and what they will do is then sort of, I mean, obviously limit the opportunity. So if someone's an opportunistic offender, you limit the opportunity. I mean, that's, you know, incredibly straightforward. But the other thing that they will do is work with, you know, key members of the family, so trusted, you know, adult members of the family or of that person's social kind of peer network, mm-hmm. they would vet, and they would upskill those people to, you know, to sort of identify the, any potential sort of red flags, any warning signs around that guy, right, just to sort of smooth his journey back in, right, and to make sure, like as you say, you know, are we worried this guy's going to be chatting to someone over the fence? Well, you know, let's make sure that doesn't happen.
Wow, that's so much responsibility for someone. So do Corrections Victoria, do they have the resources to help long-term with that, or is that like the family's responsibility?
Look, I'm not that across all the details of their program. Certainly it is a program, so it is a resourced program that's part of Victoria Corrections.
Yeah.
Look, I mean, the reality is families do that anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, people come to me fairly frequently and say, we've got Uncle So-and-so coming out of jail. Actually, we don't want to send him to an island somewhere or a desert. He's part of our family and he's coming back. How are we going to manage that? So actually doing that work around skilling those people up and supporting them to do it, I think is, you know, an inherently sensible idea.
That's amazing. So you get forgiving families. You get families who do want to integrate people back into the family unit. I just imagine that people are cast out forever. Yeah. That's my in my imagination, you know, that we never talk about Uncle So-and-so ever again. We forget he exists.
Yeah. I mean, look, obviously that happens as well. And I guess that comes down to a whole range of factors, you know, how long-term the offending was, how serious it was, how many victims there were, what the family unit was like previously. You know, there's a whole range of variables there. But, I mean, you'd be surprised. Some of these guys come out and they go back to their wives, you know.
Wow.
And in terms of community safety, that's a massive win. So, you know, if families want that, if families want offenders to reintegrate in a safe way back into their family, we should absolutely support them, you know, to do that in a way that they can feel confident, that's safe for them. You know, I mean, let's be real. If a guy comes out of prison and he doesn't have a family to go back to or any network or anything else, and he's just roaming around in these in really unstable situations, he's going to pose a bigger risk.
Coming up on Australian True Crime, Dr. Kelly gives us a rather terrifying estimate of how many child sex offenders there are in our communities. Coming up on Australian True Crime, we circle back to this Circle of Support and Accountability, or COSA, programs that aim to help child sex offenders reintegrate safely into society. It's currently being trialled in South Australia, and Kelly explains exactly how it works and where the volunteers fit in. But first, we need to talk about the Coalinga Centre in California, where the lock 'em up and throw away the key approach is favoured. Here's a snippet from Louis Theroux's excellent documentary, A Place for Pedophiles, in which he was given unprecedented access to the facility, its staff and inmates.
Mm-hmm. This is Coalinga, a mental hospital in California built to contain and treat the state's most serious sex offenders.
What was your original conviction for?
I was committed for lewd and lascivious acts on two minor children, females, ages 10 and 12.
These men all served prison time for child molestation and rape. But since completing their sentences, instead of being released, they've been diagnosed with sexual disorders and sent here against their will.
Okay, let's be real clear. I want this on record. I am not now attracted to children. I don't seek out the affections of children, nor do I want to have sex with children. Is that clear?
Coalinga has been hailed by some as the best solution to the problem of paedophilia. It's also been accused of being a kind of prison in disguise. For the first time, it had opened its doors to a documentary crew.
Part of the problem with Coalinga, apart from the fact that it's nearly bankrupted California, is that it's not making a distinction between very risky guys and everyone else who form the majority, right? And so, I mean, in the US, you know, people can be deemed a sex offender, you know, for having sex with their younger girlfriend, for example. I mean, I've heard cases of public urination that have been deemed to be sex offences.
Yeah.
And so what you've got is a situation where 10% of those guys in Coalinga probably do pose a risk. I mean, you know, there's a whole bunch of issues with detaining someone indefinitely, but many of them probably don't need to be there and could be managed safely in the community for much for much less money.
Yeah.
If you know, if we just had some sort of sensible process in place for doing that. I mean, and the other thing, you know, guys are starting to come out of Coalinga. I've met guys who've come out of Coalinga. I met someone who was in, he was in prison proper for about 25 years and then in Coalinga for another 25 years, roughly. And then they dumped on the street with literally the clothes on their back and, you know, nowhere to go, no money. I mean, dumping guys on the street like that is asking for trouble. I mean, of course that guy's going to go and commit another offence. He doesn't know how to live. He's got no supports. I mean, it's dumb policy.
Yeah. At the other end of the spectrum then, let's talk about the most terrifying option, the proper paedophile. What programs? I mean, how do you work with these people if they're not part of the community that is choosing not to act upon their urge, if they are actually in the dangerous category? How do you work with them?
Well, one thing that we could do is to try and follow sort of the European model, and that is, that involves firstly acknowledging that these people are in our community.
Yeah.
It's paedophilia probably isn't as rare as we think. We think it's sort of between 1 and 5% of adult males. That's a lot of a lot of men.
Yeah.
So in Europe, they're sort of, you know, they're leaps and bounds ahead of us. So they sort of acknowledge that this is an issue. And what they've done is they've said, what we're going to do is put in treatment before people offend. So they've got the in Germany, they've got the, what they call the Dunkelfeld Prevention Project, fantastic program. You know, they advertised on television, you know, the ad was something like, you know, do you have feelings towards children that you shouldn't have or something like that.
Wow.
So this incredibly open sort of dialogue in the community that at the moment it seems just impossible to have in Australia.
Yeah.
And so that program is sort of, look, it's a year-long program, I think. It's group therapy. So it's equipping guys with the capacity to stop themselves. So it's about impulse control. It's about building in supports for them to do as much as we can to prevent them ever acting on their impulses. Actually, under the German model, even some who have offended are still accepted into that program on a confidential basis with the aim of them not acting on their impulses again. And look, that's controversial, obviously, because they sort of, the program doesn't dob them in, if you like. So they sort of got away with that.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Right. So, I mean, look, that is obviously problematic, but at the same time, you know, on a pragmatic level, if we're trying to stop guys either offending in the first instance or reoffending, that's a win. The really interesting thing about that program is based in Germany. Men travelled from across Europe, so there were men travelling from the UK to access this support. So that, to me, screams really loudly that there are men in the community who want this support, and they will access it if we make it available to them. You know, there's so much resistance around it, but I mean, to me, it only makes sense that we've got a risky population in the community. You know, let's try and work with them to, you know, prevent them from ever acting on those impulses. At the moment, guys in Australia, I mean, you know, I've got people contacting me all the time saying, who can I go and speak to? They're terrified of even admitting that they've got those feelings.
Yeah.
And they're terrified of going to ask for help, you know, in case they are sort of turned over to the cops or, you know, stigmatised in some other way. So we need to, you know, have a really sensible conversation in the community about doing some of this prevention stuff. The Stop It Now hotline, you know, this is a great initiative that's in place in North America and Europe where people can confidentially, you know, call a hotline if they're concerned about their own feelings towards children, or if someone, you know, is looking at their son or their brother and thinking, oh, you know, I think he might be developing some of those feelings, then they can also call that hotline, you know, find out where they can go for concrete support.
Yeah, I mean, I have thought for a long time that we treat people who commit child sex offences like they're freaks of nature, but there's just too many of them. Like, it must be, it's really common part of human sexuality, isn't it?
It is absolutely rife.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is what, you know, the whole let's send them to a desert thing. I mean, geez, we'd lose a big part of the population if we did that, because this behaviour is not as uncommon as people realise. You know, it's actually, it's a very common offence, and that's only the ones we know about that go through the court, you know. I mean, and we know that the vast majority are not actually reported. They don't end up in court. So, yeah, this is an incredibly common behaviour. I mean, you only have to look at the Megan's Law registry that they have in California. No, it feels like, you know, 10% of Californians are on that bloody register. I mean, if you go on there and it's publicly available, you know, I went on there recently and typed in the name Robert, and there was something like 3,000 Roberts in California on the registry, you know.
Wow.
I mean, it's almost like everyone's on it. And if everyone's on it, it's a pretty useless kind of tool, you know. So, you know, again, it's we're doing this wrong, you know. We're using this blanket approach to a group of offenders who are actually incredibly diverse. We're wasting resources on the low end, and we're not, you know, sinking them into that harder end around, you know, prevention and around dealing with the really risky guys.
So Megan's Law is the law in which, you know, sex offenders are listed publicly on the internet or whatever. You can find out if they live in your neighbourhood, and does it have their addresses?
Yes.
Wow.
It has their addresses, and if they are homeless, it tells you sort of where they usually hang out.
Wow.
Which park bench. It lists their offences, you know, it's got their photographs. The thing about the register is that actually research shows that a lot of people don't even access it. So everyone wants it.
Yeah.
There's real public support for it, but actually adults tend not to access it and have a look at it anyway. But, I mean, the thing that worries me about it the most is that it, you know, it fosters this false sense of security, because everyone thinks, oh, well, you know, there's no one on my street who's on the register. Well, I hate to break it to you, but that's just because they haven't been caught yet. There will be someone on your street who's committed an offence or will commit an offence. I mean, that is basically how rife this stuff is. So in a way, the register is completely redundant. Just assume that there is a child sex offender on your street, because there probably is. And, you know, and we should all be acting from that premise, basically.
That is incredibly intense when you put it that way. Wow. And do you ever, I mean, do you work with victims' families at all, or is that part of your remit, or do you ever hear back? Do you get blowback from people saying you're focusing on the wrong people?
Yes Absolutely. So the recent research I did around public opinion, which looks specifically at public opinion around circles of support and accountability, look, there is a lot of, on one hand, there is a lot of victim resistance, and that comes partly from the feeling that resources should be spent on victim survivors in the community, yeah. You know, better psychotherapeutic measures and supports and so on. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. I think the message here is that actually victims and perpetrators are not on opposing sides. We all want the same thing here. We all want a safe community for our children.
Mm.
So, yes, we absolutely need better resourcing for victim services, but we're also nuts if we don't intervene with the perpetrators who we know are perpetrators, right? So we've got a population who we know are at risk. Of course we should do whatever we can to prevent them perpetrating further harm. And the other interesting thing about victim survivors is that they're actually involved in circles of support and accountability in many parts of the world. So they, you know, play a really important role actually in reintegrating offenders in ways that they think are safe and they think are appropriate. And so victim survivors, you know, they bring this incredible knowledge and expertise and accountability for offenders. So they're, you know, very much a part of that. And I think, you know, to the extent that they can be, that can only be, you know, a positive thing.
So, I mean, obviously, as you've been talking, we realise that oftentimes the victim and the perpetrator are in family members. So how do circles of support and accountability actually work in a practical sense? Is this a literal circle? Is this a therapeutic environment where the whole family sits and talks, or how does this work?
Sure. Okay. So circles of support and accountability is a model for reintegrating sex offenders, mostly child sex offenders, that originated in Canada a couple of decades ago, and it's spread across the globe, although it's still very early days here in Australia.
Mm.
So what they do is when there's a guy coming out of prison who wants to be part of the process and who lacks support in the community, then the program will recruit and train appropriate volunteers from the community, and those volunteers act as a sort of a wraparound support for the offender as he reintegrates. But they're also a measure to hold him accountable.
Mm.
Okay, so that can be things like, they form a relationship with the offender, who they call up the core member of the circle. So they come to know him. So they come to know when he's acting out, when he's stressed, when he's feeling unstable, when he is saying or doing things that are red flags. And so they work with him with the support of professionals. So the volunteers themselves are lay community members, but they have the support of professionals like psychologists, parole officers, and so on, who they can go to, you know, for support and advice, and so on as the offender reintegrates. So the purpose really of COSAR is acknowledging that instability for these offenders is one of the key drivers of reoffending. So when offenders are out in the community, you know, no finances, no housing, no one, you know, no kind of steady, healthy, functioning adult relationships, no real reason to stay in the community, you know, nothing particularly to live for or to nothing to get them to stay out, no incentive to stay out.
Mm-hmm.
So this model sort of provides stability, support, and relationships that should give that offender, you know, incentive to live offence-free in the community.
And supervision, I guess, to a certain extent.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, if there's typically five or six volunteers in a circle, so there's suddenly five or six more people supervising, in inverted commas, that offender. Now, it is supposed to be a supportive model, but of course they are there watching that offender. So they know, you know, if he said he was going to be somewhere at 1 o'clock on Tuesday and he wasn't, if one of the conditions of his order is that he's not allowed to drink alcohol, if that's a trigger behaviour for his offending, and he turns up reeking of alcohol, right? So there's suddenly all these other people watching. And, you know, and while they really are supposed to be building a friendship and a relationship of trust, that doesn't always work. And there's plenty of cases where the core member isn't being accountable for his behaviour. He's breaching his order. He's doing dodgy things like, you know, watching pornography online if he's not meant to be doing that. He's forming a new relationship with a single mother, for example.
Yeah.
He's got young children. And there's plenty of examples internationally where the circle have identified that behaviour. They've reported that behaviour back to the authorities and the offender's been breached and gone back into prison.
Wow.
And while that's not the ideal outcome of a circle of support and accountability, it's still a good outcome. I mean, if community safety is the end goal, and it is, then, you know, again, that's a win.
So it definitely requires a certain attitude in the community. It's a real community effort, isn't it?
It absolutely is. Look, it requires acknowledging that sex offenders come from our community, then return to our community.
Yeah.
It requires the community saying, you know, this is a problem. We want to be part of the solution. We want to take some ownership of this. Look, it's not everyone's cup of tea, obviously, and these programs do struggle to recruit volunteers.
Yeah.
But we know that those who have been involved, by and large, say that it was a really great experience for them. They've learnt new skills. They've, you know, formed new friendships. They feel that they've done something really positive in the community, that they've made a positive change. And you know, they quite often then sign up for another circle, or they bring in some of their contacts to be volunteers as well. So certainly the message that we get from COSA volunteers is that it's a really worthwhile endeavour for them.
So where are we at in Australia? We've had a trial in Adelaide, is that right?
We are currently having a trial in Adelaide.
Right.
So it's a very small scale program run by a non-government organisation down there. And look, it's very early days for that program. I am involved in the evaluation of it, so I'm not really at liberty to talk too much about it.
No.
But certainly, you know, it's public knowledge that trial is underway, that it is supported by a very small grant from Creative Services in South Australia, and that we will have some results of that sort of over the next couple of years.
Wow. Okay. And is it your, I think dream sounds like a weird word to use, but your goal that this would be rolled out nationally?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. I mean, the thing about COSA is that they're a total no-brainer.
Okay.
The international evidence is, and look, it isn't, you know, there hasn't yet been a very large-scale, very long-term randomised experiment that shows unequivocally that COSA work, but there have been a lot of research studies in the UK and in Canada and North America and parts of Europe, and all of that evidence looks pretty promising. So it looks as though COSA do reduce actually not just sexual reoffending but violent reoffending, and that they save a lot of money because anything that reduces crime reduces cost. So, you know, overwhelmingly that evidence looks really promising. And so of course, we would want to implement that here in Australia. Yes, there was some community resistance to that Adelaide program, but people, you know, really need to be aware that COSA aren't used instead of prison. They are used after prison. So it's either doing COSA or really doing nothing. That's the alternative. The alternative is sort of, you know, opening the gates of the prison and saying, be good. Good luck with that. And, you know, that is ridiculous. That is burying our heads in the sand and hoping that things will be okay. You know, alternatively, we could be proactively working as communities to do something that looks, you know, like it's really working overseas.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary idea, but it does seem to make a lot of sense. Kelly, thank you so much for your time. I've learnt an incredible amount because it's also something none of us really wants to talk about, isn't it?
Look, it is, but at the same time, I'm getting more and more interest in this topic. So
okay.
I'm optimistic. I think that the times, they are a changing, and I think people are I think there's those little cracks, and we're starting to have some more sensible conversations about this stuff. So I'm going to stay optimistic about it.
If we have any listeners right now who either are experiencing inappropriate feelings about children or feel as though someone they know is, what would you advise them to do? Who should they contact?
Yes, that's the million-dollar question. I think I would probably start with a GP. Mm-hmm. And try to get a referral to a psychologist with specialisation in sexology.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. I know I promised another former homicide detective this week, but unfortunately it's just taking a little while to get clearance of that interview. We've had to go through the Victorian Police Media Centre, and they take this stuff very seriously, which is fair enough. And thank you also to everyone who's taken the time to give us nice reviews and 5 stars on iTunes. It's definitely helping more people find us. We'll be back next week with another episode of Australian True Crime.